Mr. Peterson, are you there?
I am.
How are you?
I'm good.
You know, I was just introducing you earlier on in the show, and I was thinking, college professors, they call it college here in America, university professors are in a unique situation because as far as society goes, we've chosen the smartest people, the best at arguing, and then we put you in a room with the most annoying people society has to offer. And your job is to tame this beast. It must be exhausting.
Well, you know, I really like being a university professor, and I've got pretty much nothing but positive things to say about my students and the university. I mean, the students at the University of Toronto are an extraordinarily hardworking and terrified bunch. And they're terrified because they're very uncertain about their economic future. And they're hardworking, well, partly because they are hardworking, but partly because the University of Toronto is actually quite a difficult university to get into. And so they're pretty much nose to the grindstone types, you know. And
right.
And the U of T is also, I wouldn't say, a particularly politically correct institution, despite the noise over the last couple of weeks. We've managed to escape the worst excesses of the campuses on the campuses in the U.S. And I'm really hoping that will continue, which is part of the reason why I've been making the video as I've been making and making the statements I've been making, because I would just soon see it stay that way. But it isn't going to for long unless people wake up.
Well, you see so many professors kowtowing to all this, and I think, wait a minute, don't you guys have tenure? If anyone should be speaking out against this lunacy, it should be professors. But they keep stepping down, and in America we have all these presidents of universities stepping down. I thought academia was immune.
Well, there's a couple of things that's worth thinking about there. I mean, one of my colleagues put it quite well. He said, the personal risk of speaking out is very great, and the net social consequences is very small.
Right.
And so each time a person is put on the spot, the price they pay for saying something might be their career. And then, you know, it's a drop in the bucket in the social debate. Now, you know, you'd think that tenure would offer protection for that. But, and I suppose it does to some degree, but I've certainly spent some anxious moments over the last 3 weeks considering what I might do if I was put on administrative leave, or if action was taken against me, or if I lost my job, you know. So, and, you know, it's also not really the case that people are particularly, I would say, courageous in defense of their moral positions. And that's partly sometimes because they don't know how to articulate a defense. I mean, just because you're a specialist in cell biology, you know, doesn't mean you know how to handle social justice warriors. It's not the simplest thing in the world to do.
Well, they're so effective at using propaganda. They start with a basic sort of a boiled down motherhood statement of what's going on. Transsexuals, trannies are being killed. We have legislation to prevent that. Why would you want to prevent that? And I think a lot of millennials will fall for that sort of boiled down version. Like they do that with gay marriage. They go, two people are in love. They want to get married. What, do you hate love?
Right. Well, the thing is that it's easy for every issue to fall into the ideological black hole.
Yeah.
And certainly that's what's happened with the discussion that I've been having, because I said that I thought that a number of different legislative moves in Canada were dangerous, and I seriously believe that. And the issue that happened to come up was enforced pronoun use, essentially. I said I wouldn't use made-up words to replace the pronouns that everyone uses. I'm not going to do it. And so the problem with fighting political correctness is that you have to take the general problem, which is this global, radical, egalitarian, and censorship-oriented ideology. And then you have to make it a specific battle, because otherwise the tire doesn't hit the road. You know, there's no point to the argument. But the problem is, as soon as you make a point out of the argument, then you can easily be targeted as a bigot or worse. So I've been called a racist, for example, by letters that were written to the university. And, you know, people can throw those words around casually as if they mean nothing. I have pointed out that I have 450 hours of my public statements to university students in the form of my classes online, and people can comb through those with a fine-tooth comb if they want.
I love when you do that, because it gives them a homework assignment, and they're so lazy that it just shuts them down.
Yeah, well, you know, laziness, as Nietzsche said, is definitely a characteristic of the human race, that and inertia and the proclivity for oversimplification. These things are all understandable. I mean, the social justice warrior types are driven by a couple of things. They're driven by what I would call an excess of trait agreeableness. That's a technical term, because there are five personality traits, and we know from our research that the social justice types want to turn everything into a battle of compassion, essentially.
Yes.
They view the world through the lens, and I mean this scientifically speaking, I really do. They view the world through the lens of an overprotective mother. And it's useful to know that, because you see, if you're the mother of an infant, any distress cry on the part of the infant is valid. And any move to interfere with the infant or not give it exactly what it wants when it wants it is also unethical. And so it's easy to take our basic wiring and then produce a political construct out of it. And that's exactly what's happening here.
Is it possible that social justice warriors are genetically like that? I mean, I've heard theories that whether you're atheist or religious is determined at birth.
Yes, there's definitely a biological component. There's no doubt about it. And because this compassion trait that's oriented towards infant care is deeply woven into mammals. It's deeper than human, right? I mean, mammals take care of their young, and human beings have very dependent infants. And so it's the wiring for us to take care of things in distress, you know, creatures in distress, is very, very deep.
Well, if I'm sorry to interrupt, but if, you know, you menstruate at 13, 14. I don't want girls that age, obviously, breeding. But when you think about the biological clock, they always talk about it in the 30s and 40s. But in your 20s, I'm sure there's a sort of natural void there, because you didn't have kids and you've been having kids at that age for 250,000 years. So they have this maternal instinct, and it comes gushing out as protect the trannies.
You know, it's protect anyone that makes a distress cry, and
right.
And anyone who cries, essentially. And then anyone who doesn't respond is instantly cast into the category of predator. You see, and that's why the enmity mounts up quickly, because you might ask, well, why are compassionate people so vicious? And the answer is, well, they're going after people that they're seeing as predators on infants.
Right.
Now, the problem is, and, you know, Sigmund Freud did a very good job of detailing this out 100 years ago, is that an excess of compassion crushes people, because there's no call for independence or self-sufficiency. There's no call for adulthood. And of course, that's what's happening in the universities with these things like these insane safe spaces. And I can tell you as a clinical psychologist that if you want to treat someone for anxiety and depression, say, but negative emotion, the last thing you do is provide them with a safe space. What you do is guide them carefully to expose themselves to things they regard as dangerous. And that toughens them up. So these people who are making mental health statements, you know, statements on the behalf of mental health treatment, saying we need safe spaces because of these anxious people, it's exactly 100% backwards.
Yes.
It makes it worse. Yeah.
Well,
there's no excuse for it.
The other thing about this infant cry is when they see the currency it provides, it becomes addictive. It's like crack. And people start going, well, I mean, if you're going to roll out the red carpet and I'm going to have an army every time I complain, I'm going to complain.
Well, there is. Those are one of the other things that our research has indicated, and I'm going to release this week, I think, is that one of the best predictors of the desire to use language control. So we found two factors underlying political correctness, and factors are structures in which, say, opinions group together. And the first factor is radical egalitarianism, and that's driven by, those are kind of the agreeable liberals. Those are the compassionate liberal types that everybody talk about. But there's a second group of beliefs, which is basically censorship and language control. And so the politically correct people actually come in two sets of opinions. And the second set is no friend of the first set. The agreeable liberals don't realize that they're giving birth to children that are going to eat them. Because the second group of opinions is not pretty. And it involves strict language control and censorship, and it's associated with low verbal cognitive ability quite powerfully, and also with psychiatric symptomatology. So it's a rather devastating piece of research. I'm sure it's going to cause quite a furor. We're going to release it before it's been published, unfortunately, because we need to, because the time is correct. But it's a solid piece of research. And we've done research on liberals and conservatives as well, because we're trying to understand the structure of political belief and even its biological basis, because people do vote their temperament.
Well, you know, I think the pronoun thing is a great example of how insatiable these people are. And I always mirror extremist Islam with them, where and it's a bit of a hyperbolic a simile, but when you have Islam and you go to Saudi Arabia and these women who agree with you, they wear the burqa and they do all, and then they're getting caned because they've done something wrong. You know, no one kills more Muslims than Muslims. The mosque, you know, mosques getting firebombed in Pakistan because they sanctified the wrong imam or something. And we're seeing this with the left with the pronouns, because it started out there, they said, we want to add one or two. Then yeah. we say a fine, and then we tune back in, and it's 50. I think the last time we tuned into Facebook, it was up to 75.
Yeah, well, it's really interesting, because one of the things that happened with the Ontario Human Rights Commission in Ontario, Canada, which I kind of think of as Rat's Nest Central in some sense, because they have a disproportionate influence on legislation all across the country, is one of the journalists here, Margaret Wenta, called them the other day about the multiple pronoun issue and seemed to have caught them off guard. And I think what's happened is that the hypothesis was that there would be like 2.01 pronouns, right? And maybe that people would request they, which, by the way, is not a good solution because it destroys the distinction between the singular and the plural. Right. But yes, there's been this radical multiplication of identities. And so what seems to have happened is that there's a natural process underlying this, which is that some things have to be simplified down to two, or they explode into an uncontrollable many. And you see, we've never tried to mess around with gender either conceptually or linguistically before in our history, I would say. And we have no idea what will happen to our society if we do such things. But we do know at least that very rapidly we produce this incredible multiplication of identities at a rate that's even beyond the understanding of the people who were promoting this to begin with. And then the idea that perhaps we'd have to use a pronoun for each of those is it's interesting, because the argument has turned into its own absurdity almost instantly.
Yeah, it's untenable.
Yeah.
Okay, here's another thing I noticed when people argue with you, is they say, you know, this guy committed suicide because of this, and trannies are getting murdered every day. Yeah. And it's not the kind of thing you want to contradict, because if they pull up some poor bastard you hadn't heard about, then you look callous. But
yes, that's a good point.
I call bullshit. I call bullshit on these murdered trannies all over Toronto.
Yeah, well, it's an exaggeration for the purposes of compassion, and also for the purpose of manipulation. Like I don't want to say that these people are only compassionate, and that's why they're doing this. The social justice warrior types, they're also resentful. They want to pull down any sort of structure. They want to destroy all distinctions between people, particularly those that are based on actual quality and competence. And they're doing that because they're resentful. George Orwell figured that out back in the 1930s when he wrote Road to Wigan Pier, where he said the problem with socialists, and he didn't mean all of them, was that they didn't like the poor.
Yeah.
They just hated the rich.
Yes, yes.
Right, and it was a devastating critique, and he wrote that for a socialist book club, and I worked for a socialist party in Canada when I was a kid for about 4 years, and I saw people on the left. I actually worked for the father of the current premier of Alberta. So her name is Rachel Notley. I worked for her father and mother, Rachel and Sandy Notley. And the people that were working in the socialist groups in the NDP in Canada at that time really had the working class in mind and were strong advocates for their rights. And that's how Canada developed its healthcare system and our pension plan. But the problem is that no one is standing for the working class on the left anymore. They're doing this sort of resentment-oriented politics and have got far away from their original roots.
Well, the working class has Trump down here, and we've got a couple weeks to nominate him. We'll see what happens. Hey, Mr. Peterson, I want you to know that if anything bad happens to you, you have an army on your side, whether you like it or not, and we are going to destroy everyone who messed with you one by one. You know, when I was a kid...
No, I would like to say something about an army, like, because there's some utility in numbers. But, you know, one of the things we really have to keep in mind, and this is super important, it is absolutely important, the battle against the social justice warriors is a battle of rationality against emotion. And the right way to fight this war is with words, with really articulate, carefully thought through arguments and careful truth, because the truth, we can hope, can prevail. That's the hope here. And so, and I've received hundreds of letters from people supporting me. And I got to tell you, man, they've been unbelievably articulate and careful. Paragraphs long of people thinking through their arguments with extraordinary care. And that's the right path forward for this.
Yeah, well, we're Proud Boys, and we like the low road more. You know, when I was a kid in Ottawa, we were terrorized by Nazi skinheads. And I didn't find out till decades later, it was actually CSIS and the Jewish Congress who had accidentally started this Heritage Foundation, this right-wing movement, because they started out as spies, and they ended up creating a movement that wasn't even there in the first place. Next thing you know, there's Nazis all over the place, and yeah, there was
fair enough, but, you know, the problem with the low road, and it's pretty straightforward, is that, you know, you end up creating monsters that eat you, and that can happen really easily. I mean, there's a small percentage of people in the population, I would say about 2%, most of them are male, because males are more aggressive than females, and their natural territory, their natural environment, so to speak, is mayhem. That's where they thrive, and you don't want to produce the conditions of mayhem that let those people thrive, because they are no one's friends except themselves.
Maybe, but here's the story I was going to tell you. So there was a punk gang in Toronto called BFG, Bunch of Fucking Goofs. It was all one word.
Yeah, I think I remember that.
They beat up every Nazi in Toronto. Then they got in their giant bus. I think it was a school bus. They beat up every Nazi in Montreal and every Nazi in Ottawa. Boom, they were gone. You never saw one ever again. And these people are the new Nazis. So if they mess with your career, I am going to beat them up. I'm going to pummel them all.
I'm an advocate of words, and I understand that words fail upon occasion and that things descend into conflict, and I'm seriously hoping that things haven't got that far so far.
All right. I mean, well, it's very clear you do not advocate violence. That doesn't mean that you don't have an army behind you ready to kill. I'm exaggerating, but you get my point.
I get your point. Believe me, I get your point.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson, and good luck with that mob.
Thank you. Thank you for talking with me.
Cheers. Why did I keep saying Mr. Peterson? What is this, a 1950s play? Professor. We have a lot of unturned stones here. Unturned.